ॐ भगवताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्बत्वाम् अनुसन्ततामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी.
Chapter 4.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Imam Vishwate Yogam. Imam Vivaswate Yogam. Proktavan Ahamavyayam. Proktavan Ahamavyayam. Vivaswan Manave Praha.
Vivaswan Manave Praha.
Manurikshwakave Pravit.
Manurikshwakave Pravit.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Imam Vivaswate Yogam. Proktavan Aham Avyayam. Vivaswan Manave Praha. Manuhu Ikshwakave Abravit.
I think you have these two together. Let's do the next one.
Evam parampara praptam.
Evam parampara praptam.
Imam Rajarshayo Viduhu.
Imam Rajarshayo Viduhu.
Sakale Neha Mahata.
Sakale Neha Mahata.
Yogo Nashta Parantapa.
Yogo Nashta Parantapa.
Evam Parampara Praptam. Imam Raja Rishya. Raja Rishyaha Viduhu. Saha Kalena Iha Mahata Yogaha Nashtaha Parantapa.
Shankar introduces this fourth chapter. Really, in chapter 2 and 3, Bhagavan has given Arjuna the whole teaching. Right? And so having given the entire teaching, he's now praising the Sampradaya. Okay? And the Sampradaya really is the whole lineage of teacher, student, teacher, student, teacher, student. And here Krishna, as Bhagavan, as Ishwara, is taking it back to himself at the beginning of the creation. And Shankara talks in the beginning in the Bhasha here, that really the whole, and Swamiji also in his Bhasha that I've just passed out, really the whole Gita has to do with understanding karma yoga and jnana yoga. Karma yoga and sannyasa. So if you think of, if this is clear, this kind of, I'd say like a triad, I'm going to describe now. If this vision of the Gita is clear, then the whole Gita unfolds for you. The first thing to understand is that this knowledge is for a mumukshu, right? And so whether that person is taking to karma yoga or sannyasa, that person is a mumukshu who is gaining this, who is being exposed to this teaching. So the person being exposed to the teaching, depending upon their level of maturity, their level of composure, with the mind, whether or not the mind is naturally contemplative, naturally abiding, depending on the condition of the mind that student has, it is better to take to karma yoga or to sannyasa. Because karma yoga itself, that way of being in the world, having the proper attitude toward one's activity, leads to the contemplative mind. And even if a person were to take sannyasa as a lifestyle, if that mind had not already reached a level of being naturally contemplative, that person would have to practice karma yoga, right? In order to, until that kind of karma yoga buddhi becomes kind of second nature, in a sense. Karma yoga buddhi resolves really into the mind's resting in the hopefulness of myself. That's what the karma yoga buddhi gives me, a relative peace because of my relationship with Ishvara. I'm properly situated in this world, and I see the results of my actions coming from the Lord, and my priority is really Dharma, to do my Dharma, right? And to do it well, to live the life that's as it comes to me, to live that life with a certain kaushalam, skillfulness, and understanding of Dharma, adharma, and to receive and to take the results of all of my actions as prasad, with that prasada buddhi. That gives me, that gives the mind a way of being in the world, fulfilling my desires, working with my raga dveshas, working with my likes and dislikes, in a way that will allow the mind to gain a natural shanti, even while doing that. And as I gain a shanti, even while a peacefulness of mind, a composure of mind, even while I'm very engaged in the world, that mind is conducive to my gaining this knowledge. If a person already has a contemplative mind when they come to this knowledge, then that mind is already conducive to gaining this knowledge. Right?
Yeah.
And so through karma yoga, your mind becomes conducive to gaining this knowledge, or your mind is contemplative and it becomes conducive to gaining this knowledge. So whatever suits you, right? Whatever suits you, in terms of the disposition with which you come to that knowledge, these are the devices available to you. And then say for a person who doesn't take sannyasa, never take sannyasa. Not because their mind's not contemplative, but because it doesn't occur in their prarabdha. Like they give the example of Janaka or some of the great kings who spend their entire life being engaged in samsara, engaged in taking care of the world, taking care of their responsibilities. Still, for that person still engaged in the world, or the person who has taken sannyasa, they can have jnana nishtha, which then we call sarva karma sannyasa. Whether you're a karma yogi, whether you're engaged in the world, or whether you've taken the sannyasa, the jnani is the one who has sarva karma sannyasa, which means there's a renunciation of all karma, which can only take place by the recognition that myself is free from karma. My being is free from karma. It has never done karma. It never will do karma. Right? And it's not doing karma right now. It's totally free from karma. That's the only thing that is free from karma completely is the Atma. And so whether a person is living in the world as a householder or engaged in the world or has taken sannyasa, both have to realize, right, or the one who's practicing karma yoga or taking sannyasa, neither one necessarily has knowledge. It's because a person has taken sannyasa, that doesn't mean they're a jnani. Because a person's just a karma yogi, that doesn't mean they're a jnani. It doesn't mean they're not a jnani either. It doesn't mean what makes a person a jnani is that they've recognized myself, the one who is the whole, the one who is free from karma. So the whole Bhagavad Gita, and why the Bhagavad Gita is something that is really held by every householder, every person. The Gita makes the Upanishads, the vision of the Upanishads, available to everyone. You know, and that's why it itself is considered as an Upanishad, because it gives, not only gives you this knowledge, it also gives you all of the, what we call upayanishtha, all of the sadhanas, all of the means necessary to gain the antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind that can allow you to enjoy, to gain this knowledge and enjoy the fruit of this knowledge. Enjoy the fruit of this knowledge is where the mind itself says, all is well with me. The mind itself, I know all is well with me, but the mind also enjoys the pala of that fact. Because I'm all is well with me even if my mind's miserable. But when the mind assimilates this knowledge, gains jnana nishtha, right, then for that mind also, all is well for it. You see what I mean? There's a peace of mind that comes from this knowledge. That's the jnana pala, the result, the fruit of the knowledge. Okay. I consider that a secondary gain. Whether my mind is at peace or not, that's nice. We'd all rather have a peaceful mind. We'd all rather have a healthy body. Yeah. Who wants a agitated mind? But agitated mind or peaceful mind is almost inconsequential to the nature of the self, your being that's illuminated, which is free in either case. That's what the liberation is. These are secondary gains, that your mind happens to be peaceful along, become peaceful along the way. That's a second, is a very big secondary gain. It's a big secondary gain. But it's a secondary gain because the mind's not really trustworthy by nature. The mind's always changing. It's, you know, just as samsara, the mind's always changing. Now, so if you're dependent on your mind being a particular way, if you're dependent upon that, then you're what? Remember that guy Marco? He used to sit in the corner, and kind of an old guy. He was a, you don't remember him?
No, that was before us.
No, that was before our time. I remember him.
He said, "I'll get it."
It's right there. He's a funny old guy.
He was a great guy.
Tall and skinny.
He spent a lot of time in the Ramakrishna mission serving the sannyasis there for years, for many, many years. And he came to our class for many years. Many years. Maybe he came for 8 years, a long time. And one time he said, you know, without this knowledge, you become just like a maintenance man. You're a maintenance man for your mind, you know? It's true. Say all you have to have it, for you to be enlightened or full or whole, your mind has to behave in a particular way. Then that means you're a karta. You're a doer then. You have to be watching over your mind, you know, to make sure that it's peaceful. Because if the mind is peaceful, then I'm a jnani. If the mind's not peaceful, I'm not. But another better way of saying that is like this. If the mind is peaceful, I'm peaceful. If the mind is not peaceful, I'm not peaceful. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. You have to, if the viveka is there, you have to be able to say, not as a, what do you call it, like kind of an intellectual understanding, but as a reality for your own inner presence. If the mind is peaceful, I'm peaceful. If the mind isn't peaceful, I'm peaceful. If the mind is unhappy, I'm not unhappy. Why? Because my swarupa, the very being that I am, is the one that's illumining and present and pervasive to whatever the vritti is, whatever the emotion is. And if that's been differentiated, then the mind, the mind enjoys that differentiation. My presence is aparoksha. Aparoksha means it is self-shining. It's not dependent on something else illumining me, because I'm the sun illumining everything that's there. Right? So whatever is there is getting illumined and therefore experienced. But I'm not changing by that experience. And that is aparoksha. Right? Aparoksha means I am my own experience. I don't need somebody to tell me that. Once the ajnana has been removed, I don't need the mind to even check on me. Because I am the constant. Right? We even think, this is so important, we even think that, well, I'm the constant, but don't I need the mind to be saying, you're the constant? Or for the mind to be saying, oh, look, the Atma is constant. Or to have a recognition that the Atma is constant. No, that is not true. Because once the ajnanam has been removed, what the fact is that you are the constant, and that constant experience is always there, and the superimposition has been seen through. Right? So the superimposition doesn't grab you anymore, and so the constant that you are remains constant. That's just what we mean by aparoksha. Right? Your mind can comment on it, but whether it's commenting on it or not, whether it's absorbing itself into that fact or not, you've already recognized that to be yourself, and the ignorance that has caused you not to see that isn't there any longer. And so that's why there is literally no maintenance. That's why we call all of this a secondary gain. It's because the aparokshatvam of my being is the constant me. Now, this aparokshatvam of your being for the ajnani, okay, for the ajnani, that aparokshatvam is still there. But it's there with the adyasa of I am this body. The self-experience is still aparoksha, but it's superimposed on this body and superimposed on this mind. The aparokshatvam is there. You don't doubt yourself being here. You don't have, see, as an ajnani, you don't have to walk around saying, oh, look, I am the body. You know? Oh, look, I am here. I am here. You don't need to do that. You don't need to verify your presence. But you totally take for granted that the aparokshatvam, the self-experience, is this body, mind, sense, organs. You just take that for granted. You don't realize that this aparoksha atma, self-evident atma that I take for granted, is free. Means that if the whole universe goes away, it is here. I am here. That my being, the aparokshatvam, that what makes me me, is not at all dependent on the body or the mind or the sense organs. We have spent lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes, under this illusion. Because until knowledge takes place, this is what the mind will naturally feel. And sense organs naturally feel. It always enjoys me, so why isn't it me? It always enjoys me. As long as the body is here, it enjoys me, so why is it not me? Right? So this viveka has to come and take place. But once the viveka, once the jnanam is there, that viveka has taken place, then I am me, the same me that was here taken to be the body, which I didn't have to go around questioning all the time about that, checking it out, am I still here? No. But now this same me has been differentiated and recognized as free. And now when all of these thoughts, all of these moods, all of these emotions and the world is changing, the whole samsara, the whole manifest knowledge of the creation goes on changing, the ignorance that had caused me to superimpose the one on the other is not there anymore. And so my being shines as it is. And I am that. See, so that is jnanam. That my mind totally relaxes because of that and goes, oh, what a great relief. That's moksha for the mind. Right? But the real moksha is the recognition that I am free. Because the only one that's really free is me, is the Atma. And so liberation is the praptasya praptihi, right? The achievement of the achieved. It's literally the achievement of the achieved. And so now, Krishna has finished up all of this, talked all about the difference between sannyasa yoga and karma yoga, has given the knowledge, and so now he says, so Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, now Bhagavan says, he says, imam yogam vivaswate. This yoga to vivaswat is the name for the sun or the king of the solar dynasty. It's also the name for the Lord's Son. Okay? Imam yogam proktavan. Proktavan is a past active participle that you haven't learned yet. It means I taught. Ukta means to tell, to teach. Pra-ukta, prokta, means to teach clearly, thoroughly. So, aham proktavan. So now this is the Lord, this is Krishna speaking, Lord Krishna speaking. I taught imam yogam, which is avyayam, imperishable. This teaching, this yoga, which is imperishable, I taught this to Vivaswat. The lord of the solar dynasty means the one who comes at the beginning of the creation. Okay?
Who?
The Vivaswat, the sun.
Oh.
Means the god of the sun. Okay? It means I taught it to the first, the lord, the Vivaswat was also, if we look at this just in the, what do you call it, like the cosmology, there's the solar dynasty and the lunar dynasty, and Vivaswan was the first king of the solar dynasty, so that the one who came at the beginning of the creation. It's also a name for the lord in the form of the sun. If you take it as the solar the king of the first king of the solar dynasty, when the creation first becomes manifest, Krishna now is speaking as Ishvara, and says, "I taught this knowledge to Vivaswan, this yoga to Vivaswan, this yoga which is immutable, this yoga that is what's the word they use in the book? Avyayam, it won't perish. It's imperishable. I taught this imperishable yoga to Vivaswan. Vivaswan Manave Praha. Vivaswan taught it to Manu. Manuhu Ikshwakave Abravid. And Manu told Ikshwaku, his son is named Ikshwaku. Manu is considered like the first, one of the first teachers, one of the first fathers. Who was the Manus were the ones who taught the Dharma, right? So this is just he's just giving a lineage. So Bhagavan is saying at the beginning of the creation, I taught this to Vivaswan. Vivaswan taught it to Manu. Manu taught it to Ishvaku. So what he's doing by this verse is taking this knowledge, which he's now giving to Arjuna, because he says, Imam yoga, this teaching, in the form of karma yoga and jnana yoga, right? So this teaching, I myself, so here's Krishna's talk, because Arjuna's going to say, what? So I myself taught this yoga to Vivaswan, who taught it to Manu, who taught it to Ishvaku. So it takes it back to the beginning of the creation. And then he says, Evam, in this manner, parampara praptam imam. Imam means this yogam, imam yogam, which is parampara. A parampara is from guru to sisha, in succession. So, in this manner, obtain praptam, obtain successively, in succession, from guru to sisha. That's the parampara. Parampara is when anything is passed on. A piece of knowledge, say for instance, the knowledge is passed from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student, that lineage. So, this knowledge which has been obtained through this lineage of Guru Sisha, or from successively, okay, the Raja Rishihis, Viduhu, knew. The Raja Rishi, so this is interesting, the kings who were Rishis. So Swamiji talks quite a bit about this in his Vasha, so you have to read it. But in the beginning, all of the kings who ruled the kingdoms also were Rishis. They also had knowledge. And so they were able to really rule the kingdoms from the standpoint of wisdom, right? From the wisdom of Jnani. So the kings themselves were Rishis. So he says, this knowledge had been passed down, you know, successively. What knowledge? The knowledge that all of the Raja Rishis, the kings who were themselves Rishis, knew. Rishis are those who are the ones that have really held this knowledge and passed this knowledge. They're like the first teachers. The first teachers themselves were Rajas, were kings. But then he says, but Saha Yoga, that very yoga, which all of the Raja Rishis knew, Kalena Mahata, through the passage of time, by great period of time, Mahat means great period, long, great, Kala, through great time, so Kalena Mahata, by the passage of great time, here, in this world, so after a great time has passed in this world, this Yogaha Nashtaha, this teaching perished. Means that the teaching became the parampara, the lineage was lost, became lost. Hey Parantapa, so he's now, he addresses Arjuna, hey, you who burn to a crisp all of your foes, the ones, the destroyer of foes, the one who destroys the other. See, interesting. The other meaning those who are against you, but it's also the one who burns the other, who destroys the other. It's kind of interesting. But it's a name for a warrior who is able to burn to a crisp, destroy all of his foes. So, hey Parantapa, Parantapa, this yoga that all the Raja Rishis knew, which had been passed down from generation to generation to generation, that through the passage of time, through the, you know, the long passage of time, here now at this time, this teaching has been lost. It means it's been weakened. Lost in a couple of ways. They say traditionally, and we'll see as we go through here, this knowledge is never lost, because as soon as it starts to become lost, or when soon as there's an imbalance of dharma or adharma, the Lord will come. The Lord will take form in order to bring the creation back into order. Once there's too much adharma, once there's nobody there, the minds are all confused. The minds are all confused, and the lineage is being lost. The dharma is. A dharma is taking over. At that time, this the knowledge has to be reinvigorated, and dharma again has to be given a shot in the arm, so that it's not overwhelmed by a dharma. So that's actually what he's going to be talking about in this section. So let's read the next thing that he says. Sa eva yam maya tedya, sa eva yam maya tedya, yoga prokta puratanaha, yoga prokta puratanaha, bhakto sime sakha cheti, bhakto sime sakha cheti, rahasyam hetad uttamam, rahasyam hetad uttamam. Sa eva ayam maya te adya yogaha proktaha puratanaha bhaktaha asi me saka cha iti rahasyam hi etad uttamam. See, he says that alone, saha eva ayam, that alone is this. Right? Saha yogaha eva ayam. That yoga which all the kings who were rishis used to know. When all of the kings were rishis used to know, then that yoga was predominant in the society. That knowledge was much more readily available. Right? But over time, that has been lost. Okay? But it is that yoga, that very yoga, is this yoga, mayate adyaha proktaha, which is taught proktaha today to you by me. It's so beautiful. You know, so Krishna says, it's that yoga, not anything else. It's that saha eva, you know, ayam yogaha. It is that very yoga. Adya means today, maya, by me, to you, proktaha, is being told. That yoga which is puratanaha. Puratanaha means ancient, at no beginning, it's ancient. It's that yoga which is I taught to Vivaswam. It's absolutely ancient. And Swamiji in his Bhasha, it's so beautiful. He talks about knowledge itself is ancient. In other words, there is no real beginning to knowledge, because knowledge matches the reality. The example he uses is, say for instance, the fact that the earth goes around the sun. Right? The earth rotates around the sun. The earth has always rotated around the sun. Even when that was not known, the earth was rotating around the sun. And so that knowledge, the reality of that, has always been. And like that, the reality of this has always been. That this truth that I'm teaching you today, this truth has always been from the beginning. But the passing on of that truth, there was a weak link in it. When all of the rishis knew, when all of the kings knew who were rishis, then that knowledge was more available. And also at that time, the sattva, if you go back in time to the different yugas, the beginning yugas, there was a lot more sattva in the antakarana. So people were, the knowledge itself was more readily available. Now not only is it something being held by all of the kings, because look at Duryodhana, look at the Pandus, you know, with the Kauravas. So there's a lot of adharma that's being mixed in the society now. So there's this whole war is a war over dharma and adharma. And so it is not so evident in the society, nor are the people themselves open to it, right? Because their minds are also scattered. Because of wanting this and wanting that, and scattered because of adharma. So Swamiji does a nice thing on that. But anyway, here it says, yogaha puratanaha. The yoga itself, this teaching itself, is beginningless. It's ancient. And one way of looking at that is that teaching itself is true to the reality. That's one thing. The other is that there has been a parampara of the teaching methodology also. That this teaching, this Vedic teaching, is something that has been given since the beginning of time. With every cycle of every creation. You look at, there's two times of eternality. One is the nityatvam of the self, of Brahman. That type of nityatva we say timeless, right? It's timelessness. But then for the Vedas, it's a pravaha, what we call a pravaha nityatvam. It's a flow, an eternal flow, because the creation is something that comes, presents and resolves, you know, manifests and goes into dissolution, manifests and goes into dissolution from beginningless time. And what the Shruti says is that from beginningless time, with each creation, this knowledge is there. It means this Vedic knowledge, this Vedic teaching methodology is there. It comes with the creation, and it maintains itself throughout the creation. It's not just that it comes like in the first yuga, it stays in the first yuga, and then it gets drowned out, you know, by Kali Yuga, and by the end of Kali Yuga, it's just gone. So, no. It says, actually says in the Puranas, and in the tradition itself, that, and in this chapter, we'll see, Bhagavan says that, you know, this teaching is something that is always maintained, even if there's only a few pockets of people interested in it. Because most are going...
We're a pocket.
But there's another level to understand it, and that is, reality is reality, right? So knowledge matches reality. And the reality of what something actually is not going to go away, whether there's ignorance of it or knowledge of it. What it is not going to go away. If you have ignorance of something, then you're going to be behaving toward it or around it in a way which is not true to it, which is what our problem is for an Ajnani. That's what a huge problem is. We're behaving toward ourselves and toward the creation because of self-ignorance in a way that the creation is not, in a way that I am not. And so that is what causes so much strife and so much pain. But just because I'm behaving towards something in a way that it is not, doesn't change the reality of what the thing actually is. And so knowledge is that which gives me knowledge of what actually is, and what actually is beginningless. That's another level of understanding it. So here, he says, it's that ancient knowledge, that beginningless knowledge, that yoga, which I am teaching to you today, not a different one. And he starts out by saying, in the first verse, I taught this knowledge to Vivaswan. At the beginning of the creation, I'm the one that taught this to Vivaswan, and it is this knowledge, this very ancient knowledge, that I'm now teaching to you today. And then he thinking that Arjuna might wonder, well, why didn't you teach it to me before? Because actually, when you think about it, before this war, Arjuna was in the forest for 12 years, sitting there in the forest. Of course, he... Yeah. Now, what? Why now? In the middle of the battlefield. You know, when you had 12 years, we could have sat. You know? Why now? It says, you know. But Krishna, maybe anticipating this question, he says, Bhaktosi, you are my Bhakta. He says, Bhakta, you are my Bhakta. You are somebody who is devoted to me. And you are my friend, he says, Bhakta Asi Mesakacha. And you are my friend. You are my Bhakta, my devotee. And you are my friend, right? Iti. This being the, he says, this being so, then he says, Rahasyam Cha Etad Uttamam. He says, because this teaching that I'm going to give you is Uttamam Rahasyam. It is the greatest secret. There is no greater secret than this. Right? Rahasyam uttamam. Uttamam rahasyam. There's no greater secret than this. Now you are my friend. You are my devotee. And you have to remember, you have to go back to the beginning. And now you have asked me for this. See, Arjuna, he didn't ask before. It hadn't occurred to him. Before this point even... Arjuna knew that Krishna was Bhagavan. We'll see this later. This is coming. He knew that Krishna was Bhagavan. Because if you remember, when Arjuna had a choice, both he and Duryodhana came to meet Krishna. Krishna was sleeping in his bed. And they were just realizing that they were going to be going to war. So both Arjuna and Duryodhana came to Krishna. Because they wanted Krishna's blessings, you know. Because whoever really got Krishna's blessings would win, right? So when Krishna opened his eyes, he saw Arjuna first, and he gave Arjuna because he saw him first. He gave him this more complex.
Who did he see first?
Arjuna. He gave Arjuna the choice. He said, Arjuna, you can have me. You can have the choice of me, but I won't do anything. I won't fight at all. Or you can have my whole army. I could be your charioteer, but I'm not going to fight. But you can have that, or you can have the whole army. You know? And Duryodhana was thinking, oh my God. But Arjuna said right away, oh, I'll take you. Mm-hmm. I'll take you. You know. And Duryodhana was so happy.
What's a big army?
Because for a big army. For Duryodhana, you know, he didn't see Krishna in that way. But Arjuna knew. And what would be more than to have Krishna with him? And as his driver. They chose him right away. But he thought of Krishna as the Lord, as somebody, and also his friend. His friend who is also the Lord, who would always bless him, always look after him, who would always seek his blessings, always seek his counsel, always seek his wisdom. But within samsara, Arjuna's whole focus was on being a great warrior, being a king, preparing himself, and even when he was in the forest, he was only preparing for war. He was accruing different missiles and weapons and all types of skills and magical skills also in order to win this war. That was his whole focus. It really wasn't until he got into the middle of the battlefield and realized what is this? All of my family, you know, everything that is meaningful to me. We're now going to destroy. What is the truth? What is the truth of all of this? The whole thing. He became really a mumukshu. He saw through the whole thing. This is samsara. There's no way out of this. There's no way to solve this. And so at that time, he went to Krishna as a teacher. He looked at Krishna as a teacher. And he had the bhakti. Bhakti means a shraddha. You know, he had the shraddha, and he had that attitude also, the attitude of friendship, you know, closeness. But the bhakti means the shraddha. Means that when you go to a teacher, it's two things. You have a teacher, and you have the teaching. Right? So here the teaching is the Vedanta, right? The Upanishads, or whatever Krishna's knowledge would be, which would be the Vedic knowledge, the Upanishads. And then there's Krishna himself. So he would not have the heart or the disposition to be able to gain this knowledge from Krishna if he didn't have some shraddha. Shraddha is the best word for us to understand it. Some shraddha and sense of openness, sense of trust, sense of friendship, so that the words that Krishna said had an entry. Right? If your heart's not open, if your psyche's not open, how can these words that are going to the very core of your being have any entryway? They will just be some sort of an intellectual knowledge. They can't give you this. They won't have the power to give you this vision, because to have the power to give you the vision, your heart has to be available for it. That's how deep it is. It's going to the very core of your being. And so Krishna says that, I am going to teach this to you, what I taught in the beginning, because you have that shraddha, you know. And you are my friend. You have that shraddha. You are my friend. You are available for it. You are available for this, which is the ultimate secret. And it's the ultimate secret, uttamam, rahasyam. There is nothing more secret than this, because this knowledge is hidden in the seeker. Right? The knowledge itself is hidden not in the seeker, but is hidden because it is the seeker. Right? Sometimes we say it's hidden in the seeker. The problem with that is that there's someone inside the seeker that's other than the seeker. In fact, it is the one who is seeking. It's that very self, that the one who is seeking is the one who is sought. So there's not a better hiding place for that, right? And so that's what, in one way, it's the most secret. In another way, the other way it's the most secret, is that you can't gain this knowledge by yourself. You are what you need to know, and all of your means of knowledge are looking outward. So you can travel the whole universe trying to find it. But all you will find is more name and form. The jiva, the body, the mind, the sense organs, cannot get outside of the samsara. See what I mean? You have five sense organs and a mind, which are able to gain, to gather knowledge. But the knowledge they're capable of gathering is knowledge within the box of the creation. Right? Even inferences and presumptions are within the box of creation. So the knowledge as a jiva that you can gather is knowledge that exists within duality, because that's what the upadi, the jiva upadi, is willing to do, is able to do. The jiva upadi, the body, mind, sense organs with the five organs of action, is not able to gain knowledge of the one that is not an object of their of sense pursuit. Right? It's not something that can be objectified by the sense organs. It's not something which exists within duality. It's the very self of duality. It's the self of duality. The being of duality. It has nothing to do with duality itself. And so, this is where people can get confused, because it is true that the jiva can have non-dual experiences. In other words, you can have meditative experiences where you have a non-dual experience. This is why this is key to understand. You have a meditative experience, and somebody's giving you meditative techniques and whatnot, and you do it. You have a meditative experience of non-duality. However, this non-dual experience takes place in duality, it takes place in time from your perspective as a jiva. The non-dual experience is born and it goes. Right? In other words, it comes into being and it goes out of being. It's something that takes place in time. I had a non-dual experience. I decided that I would have a deep meditation today. So I came at 9 o'clock. Yeah. I sat in meditation. I had a non-dual experience. When I came out of it, I looked at my watch. It was 9:30.
Yeah.
Right? So between 9 and 9:30, I had a non-dual experience. Now, I recognized when I had that, and this is how people talk, when I had that non-dual experience, I recognized that that is the truth. There could be no greater truth than that. Then they'll often say, so now I want to get back to that. I want to get back to that experience. So not only does the experience take place, non-dual experience take place in time, which makes it dual, because there's a before and an after and now, so that's dual in terms of time, right? Because there's a prior condition, 1, 2, 3. That's not one, that's three, right? Mm-hmm. Prior, now, past, present, now, future. Then also, I had the experience and I lost the experience. That means that the point of identification is with the mind. The mind, me, the jiva, had the non-dual experience, lost the non-dual experience. And so now I have to get the non-dual experience back. This is not non-dual. It's, we call it non-dual because when that experience is there, it's a non-dual experience. There's no other thing happening. But that non-dual experience becomes one of the experiences within the box of the creation. This is the problem. The jiva, who normally experiences the world, is now experiencing a non-dual state. So the non-dual becomes an experience state, rather than the reality of the creation. To say non-dual means one without a second. That all there is that. And if you have a non-dual experience from the standpoint of yourself as a jiva, then you are the jiva having the non-dual experience, which itself is dual. See the problem? And so this is the plight of the jiva. You don't have the sense organs available built into your body to gain this knowledge, and at the same time, the knowledge for you of what you are, the self that you are, is aparoksha. So it's immediately present and completely hidden. Both. You are completely it, and you don't know that you're it. Right? That's the maya, that's the ajnanam. And so this is the uttamam rahasya. There is no greater secret than this. But it's such a great secret that very few people seek it. It's so hidden that it's the rare person that even seeks it. That's how hidden it is. So you seek it in terms of the adyasa. I want to be happy, let me have that. I want to last one more day, let me survive. You're actually timeless. There is no death for you, but of course you don't want to die, so let me extend my life for as long as I can. Doing everything we can to be ourselves within samsara. We're trying to experience ourselves within samsara. See, you see that? It's an amazing thing. And so the Vedas, this is just the tradition, how the tradition presents itself, is that the reality is as reality is. It has always been this way. And the creation, if you think of this, as we'll see later, the creation is a manifest knowledge. It's infinite intelligence. There's nothing unconscious here. It's infinite being, infinite intelligence. The Vedic knowledge itself, the knowledge of that, of the reality, has been part of that manifest knowledge from beginningless time. It's pravahim ityuktvam. It has never not been there. It comes with the creation in the form of the Vedas. The Lord himself begins the parampara at the beginning of the creation, and it continues from creation to creation to creation from beginningless time on. That's the tradition. And so that is what Krishna is saying now in this Bhagavad Gita, in this chapter 4. This is what the tradition is. This knowledge has come from beginningless time. I myself taught it to Vivaswan. That very knowledge, that ancient knowledge, I'm now teaching to you. Why am I teaching it to you now? Because you've asked for it. You have Shraddha. You're ready to gain this knowledge. And so now this great secret, there is no greater secret than this. Now you are in a disposition to gain this, and so I will give it to you. I haven't given it to you before. You haven't asked me for it. Right? If you haven't asked me for it, your mind isn't ready for it. You yourself haven't even recognized the situation. If you haven't recognized the situation, you don't even want to know this. You'd be bored to death with it. So when Swamiji's talking, he said, he can just imagine, you know, Arjuna as a prince, this knowledge was taking place here and there. Arjuna as a young man would be going in and out of it, you know, maybe hearing this, hearing that. His mind wasn't focused on that. His mind was focused on becoming an archer, you know, being a prince, doing the things that he was supposed to do. That's where his energy was. Now everything has changed. You know, of course, he had 12 years of hardship, you know. 12 years of kind of living in the poorest and living the life of a sadhu, a very kind of a reflective life in a way. And then he comes back and to win this kingdom by killing everybody. You know, he's already had a rather interesting life for 12 years in the forest. And now, in order to do his dharma, to fulfill his duty, it's time now to have the kingdom back. They refused. Duryodhana and his clan refused to give it back, even though they fulfilled all of their part of the contract. Mm-hmm. Completely fulfilled it. Mm-hmm. Duryodhana won't give their kingdom back. And so it's an issue of dharma. And Krishna, you remember in the first, in the second chapter, he says, you can't just run away. It's your duty. And if you, even if you decide to leap, Swamiji talks about this again in his Bhashya. Because I think this is really important to Swamiji. Because he's brought it up to me personally, in my own life situations. He says, brought it up again, he says, if Arjuna, even for the best of reasons, out of compassion, out of maturity, out of viveka, out of care, were to say, I will not, I'm not going to fight. How do you think the others would, how do you think Duryodhana would look at him?
As a coward.
You're running away, you jerk. You're running away. You have no dharma, you're just a coward. That's all. And so, nothing would be achieved by it. And so, it's a really interesting thing. You have to, and Swamiji's talked so much in different contexts, you have to stick it out in the hard battles that come your way. Like say, for instance, if you're, because I've had this type of situation where you're in some sort of a job, and there's enough people, or even one or two people, to make that situation miserable enough that you would rather just leave. It'd be nice just to leave. Who cares? I don't want to be there. If I have to live with that, you know. But Swamiji would always say, no. You can leave when that situation is resolved. And that situation doesn't bother you. And when everyone is happy, you know, it doesn't bother you, then you can leave. Not before. Twice in my life he's had to tell me that. Yeah. Where I'm not going to go into details. I didn't leave. And he was right. Yeah, he was right. But sometimes what you want to do is pull out because it's a difficult situation. He doesn't really have any resolution that you can see. Why should you stay and just suffer unnecessarily? You know? But if you pull out, then what would those people say? Good riddance. Yeah, it doesn't help. And then if you pull out, you'll end up in another situation where there's another difficult. Now you're going to pull out of that, and you go into another situation, there's another difficult person. What are you going to do then? Pull out of that? It's kind of like, are you looking for Swargaloka? In a Swargaloka, will you get a situation where everybody is your friend? Everybody is your friend. Everybody is on your side and is cheering you on. When you walk in the door, they're all very happy to see you. And when you leave, they're sad to see you go. It's not that way. It's not that way. Too bad, right?
That's never happened.
Like fantasy land.
So, anyway, he says, this great secret, I'm going to teach you why, because you have Shraddha, and you're my friend, and basically you're ready to hear it. And so let's stop there. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.